This tenant's got some energy today. All
right. No, I'm just trying to wake up. I'm just trying to wake up.
Wow. I think so.
Okay. We actually, the large document you have is the compilation of all of the changes we've already agreed to. Mm-hmm. The short document is the items that we have for consideration today. As you can see, that document's relatively short.
Good work.
So I think what we'll do is we'll go through the items one by one and see if there are concerns, see if there's agreement, and get an explanation both from committee staff and from some of the staff from BAM and LFO and others who might want to chime in. You want to go through the first item?
And Mr. Kosher, I'll actually turn this over to George and Rocco as they did the heavy lifting on this document, and they the changes and suggestions in the smaller document are the four statutes we identified at our last meeting that needed to be reworked, not change the statute in terms of the intent, but needed the language needed to be updated. And so Ken and George worked together to provide some new language, and I will actually turn it over to them and let them walk through their four appendices with their new language they have suggested.
Good punt, Aaron.
Well, what we tried to do was we, as Aaron said, George and I met with some other people from our offices who know the budget process. We tried to, get closer to mirroring what we actually do in the budget development process rather than what was in statute, which is outdated and uses some terminology that no longer applies. For example, in there's discussion of a tentative budget, and there's discussion of the budget report, and the use in the current statutes is no longer the current usage for those terms. So we tried to go into these sections, which was the bulk of the work, I think, for the task force, and align those with what we actually do now. So that's primarily the effort we did. So 291206, this is, we just moved to this subsection 3, and we still want to check with council on the placement of this, but we think it would work. So the sub 3 under 291206 now is slightly reworded and moved from another statute. It was stuck within the governor's budget section, and this is really something that's done more in the agency request process. So we moved it up. The way the statutes were structured, there was work about what the agencies submit to the governor, then what the governor does, and then what the legislature does. So we kept that kind of continuity, but we moved things to where they should go. And this 10% reduction options, which was something that was put into law in the last, 15 years or so, was in the governor's budget section, but it's really a function of the agency request budgets. That's where it first appears. So we reworded that slightly and then just moved it. But the intent is basically the same, that when agencies develop their budgets, they will show an alternative reduction option plan of 10% reductions. And we used to, during Ways and Means hearings, we would ask for these lists, and now with the budget instructions that are going out from the Department of Administrative Services, that's actually built right into the whole process now. So
just to clarify?
Yeah.
So the agency prepares this as part of their request to the governor. The governor incorporates some of the information. He might use some of those 10% reductions. But does that same list then just coming into the Ways and Means process, or is it adjusted after the governor's budget comes out?
It depends on the agency. Certain agencies update them for what's in the governor's budget. They'll put the stuff that the governor took higher up on the list.
That's
so they might reorder it, but it's usually the same list overall. Most agencies don't revisit the list, like bring up new items as part of that.
But that is the prerogative of the Ways and Means Committee to say, we want your list redone. We want 15%, or we want 20%, or on the governor's side, they can ask for that during the budget instruction phase. They can say, well, we know we're having a revenue shortfall, so we want more than just a 10% reduction list. So.
And we've both routinely done that. I think we asked for 25% once. 15, you guys asked for more than
20,
that.
I think.
So this is kind of the baseline.
Right.
And also, obviously, we could ask, and you've probably already seen, if the list has been revised, the original list that went before the governor prepared his budget, and if the budget's been revised, would be pretty transparent that it's been revised.
Yes.
Because those agency request budgets are public documents, LFO analysts can pull those and then pull what's in the governor's budget and see the differences.
Right.
So this applies to all fund types, and so we've routinely done that. We've had some conversation between our office. We want to maintain that. There is one other change to it, in that we have excluded debt service out of where we have to take reductions, simply because that's
not a reduction.
You have to pay for it. So we've excluded debt service out of the calculation, which we think makes sense between our two offices.
Okay. Mr. Critchard, do you need a motion on each one of these as we go, or how would you like to proceed?
Recall how we did this last time. I think last time we had so many, we didn't exactly do that on every one, but we don't have very many this time in terms of actual sections. So maybe one by one would be fine.
Mr. Co-Chair, we last time we had so many, we went through each one. The first time we didn't have nearly as many, so we waited till the end in an in-block motion. So it's really your prerogative as to which direction you prefer.
What's the preference of the committee? Any preference? Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Sim Jensen.
I don't know. I'm a little late getting my mind going here this morning, so excuse me if you've already covered this. But we're talking about the 10% reductions here and some reworking of the language. When the agencies make these, submit this particular information, is there flexibility in the executive office to accept Agency A's 10% reduction and reject the 10% reductions for Agency B?
Or so are they Mr. going Chair, to Representative Jensen, the way this works is it's just a list of options. It's a menu, if you will. And then when we on the governor's budget side go through balancing the governor's budget, we certainly do pick and choose some of these reductions that we might want. We might create other ones that the governor's interested in, and we add in policy packages.
Okay.
So there's nothing here that binds either us or you as the legislature that we have to take any of these or all of these. It is purely informational for us so that some of the pre-work is done.
A for B or B for C or
yes.
You get the agency's impression of priority.
That's fine.
Yeah. And sometimes when we get those, we look at them and we say, what were you thinking?
Yeah.
this is totally ridiculous. Please redo this for us. And I think George has that.
Occasionally Washington Monument.
Exactly. It's the Washington Monument approach. Okay. So we do have that interchange with it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fletcher.
Okay. Representative want to make your motion?
Sure. Mr. Couture, I move that the task force approve the proposed changes to Appendix 1.
It's been moved to approve the proposed changes to Appendix 1. Any additional discussion? Any objection to the motion? Seeing none, motion carries. Go on to Appendix 2.
So Appendix 2, the title was, you know, preparing the tentative budget plan, but it was referring to something that we don't really do. So we used that title and then made it into what we really actually do.
Novel concept.
And so what we added here was that DAS and LFO, and this is, we do this. In fact, we've been working on it the past couple months now, and we're pretty close to doing this. This is the what we typically talk to you co-chairs about, the tentative budget, which is basically just looking at how are you positioned for the next biennium's budget in advance of the Ways and Means process and the governor's process. It's just to give you a sense of if we're in a deficit situation, if we have a surplus, and just to start that conversation. It doesn't really ever get published or anything. It's just something that we work on to give you the information of where your relative position is compared to the revenue situation and the projected expenditure situation.
And again, it's informational in a sense, mm-hmm. that
totally
it's just providing information.
Right.
It doesn't bind anyone to any. It just gives you an idea of what the particular situation you were in, and from there you probably look at options.
And what we've done is we've used terms that are in later appendices here that we had to develop to align with what we actually do. So the terms are, you know, we're looking at the revenue forecast, the official forecast that DAS puts out, and comparing that to the what we're referring to, the projected costs of continuing currently authorized programs. And that's just that's the expenditure side. The revenue side is the actual official forecast. The combination of those is the tentative budget.
Yes.
So, Mr. Rock, if I understand what you're doing here is you're creating a tentative budget using current service level and projected inflation roll up, and comparing that to the projected income.
Yes. Without saying current service level. Without saying current service level.
Yes, I noticed that.
What was the term we used to use as a substitute?
Essential budget level.
I think that was worse.
Mr. Chair, the Washington refers to as the maintenance level budget. So most states do exactly the same kind of process, but we all have different terms to describe the same kind of projection of the what if, and that's all it is. It's a what if.
And really, it's just to give you a sense. It doesn't mean that you're going to continue all programs. It just gives you a sense if you did, this is where you're situated financially.
We have a motion.
Mr. Kutcher, I'd like to move that the task force accept appendix number two, approve appendix number two.
Any discussion of the motion before the committee? Any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries. Appendix three, this is the long one.
So in appendix three, this is really where we get into defining that current the cost of continuing currently authorized programs. And as Senator Whitsitt mentioned, the components are in, sub eight, little c. So in sub eight, little a, we added special payments to the list of and that budget report will get changed. Okay, let me back up a second. Getting ahead of myself. Every place you see in this section of law here in 291216 where it says the budget plan or budget report, that's going to be changed to the governor's budget. And we haven't shown it here because we got tired of typing. And council has a much better way of doing this than we do with a search and replace. So we've already talked to them about that. So in 8 little a, it'll say the governor's budget shall present information regarding expenses of the state in the following categories. We added one that was missing, which is special payments, which is an important one because, for example, the payment for K-12, which is roughly 40% of the budget, is a special payment. So we needed to include that as one of the categories that are listed. The rest are, we still use and on a regular basis. So in little C then, under eight, this is where we defined what we mean by the projected costs of continuing currently authorized programs. And it includes the estimated costs of removing one-time expenditures from the budget, program phase-ins and phase-outs, vacancy experience calculations, other personal service cost changes from rolling forward existing compensation plan agreements, inflation for services, supplies, and medical costs, fund shifts, mandated caseload changes, and anticipated debt service for previously issued debt. And those are the categories we look at when we're making that estimate of the how much it would cost if you continued everything that you've already approved.
And this pretty much reflects current practice?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Representative Buckley?
And then there's a couple other changes. Okay. If we go down a little bit, we're just clarifying in 9A, little a, that the budget should show both the number of positions and the FTE, the full-time equivalent positions. And then in 13, this is the one where we had where we moved to the earlier section, because this is, it's still included in the governor's budget, but the development of it occurs earlier. So we reworded that and moved it. And that's what Appendix 3 is doing.
The governor's folks are happy with this too.
Yeah, we talked a lot on C, that when we do this estimate of the future biennium, it's purely, and you'll see the very first words there, it's supplemental information. It's purely an information point. My boss obviously is concerned about how we use and how we build the budget. We're fine actually building this as supplemental information, knowing that that's not what the governor's recommending. He's going to actually recommend with his budget something different than that. But we're fine producing this as general information.
Good. Okay. Mr. Kuchar, I'd like to move that the task force approve Appendix 3.
Any discussion?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
there is a 2, but there was no change in this one. It starts with 291216.
There is no 2. There is no 2. Thank you for catching
that. Go to the next page, and we go to 3.
Oh, okay. I see what you're talking about.
It should get printed.
Good, we caught that. Ledge Council would never catch that. Just kidding.
Yeah, 2 should be in here, and we did not change it. No. 2 is the, it would say, with changing to the governor's budget, the governor's budget shall include a budget message prepared by the governor, including recommendations of the governor with reference to fiscal policy. And that would stay.
That stays.
Yeah.
Thank you. That could have been me.
Yeah.
The mysterious
section. I assume that's what it was.
Your mind has awakened, Trip.
Well, finally woke up. Yeah.
Okay, any additional discussion?
Just a question.
Yes, Senator Whitsitt.
Mr. Rocco, is there any place in where we contemplate tabulating the total amount of debt that the state has, and the and all, you know, including our loan guarantees? I mean, is there anything, are we contemplating doing that somewhere in this?
Well, I don't know if it specifically states it in this section, but I know the governor's budget document, when it comes out, includes that information right now. So.
Except for the guarantee, and we've talked about this before. I'm not sure if it fully captures all
the debt that
we owe directly. Yeah. Is in there for sure.
It's not in this document, but in the Treasurer's Debt Policy Advisory Committee document annually, all of those are actually listed, and obviously one of those guarantees has been highlighted quite a number of times in that report, and that is
Well, there's little possibility of this. We are actually guaranteeing almost about $5 billion, theoretically, as the last person in line for all local general obligation bonds that have been issued by school districts. It was a change that was made a long time ago, actually, that has enabled them to actually probably save, I think the last figure we had was $100+ million in terms of bond costs. But in theory, we've never had a school district default. Two, in theory, and I say this is in theory, we could withhold their money from the state school fund to pay the bonds if they did default. I say that's in theory because that would be a pretty difficult thing to do. But it's a concern the treasurer has raised actually a number of times, that, and the bond rating agencies haven't actually used it in a sense to saying that we're going beyond our capability. They don't include that in what are our voluntary limits of 5%.
In comparison with the private sector, Mr. Chair, if you go to your local lender and full disclosure will indicate how many, if any, loans you have guaranteed, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that is put on your balance sheet as owed.
Yeah.
It's considered in a rating agency report. You'll see it in a Moody's report or S&P. They're considered in rating agencies. Rating agencies will consider that debt, that obligation, as they're looking at your bond ratings. Yeah. So it'll get considered there. Even if it's not in your budget where you see it, they'll consider it in your rating. So.
Back to Appendix 3. Any additional discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. We'll go on to Appendix 4.
Appendix 4 is talking about when there's a new governor, the governor-elect's budget process, and Section 4A is now sort of redundant with 4B. It says, you know, first of all, we're not quite certain when the legislature actually starts meeting, because you have this organizational thing, and then you have real session starts in February, so... We
pick a date.
so we're allowing B to stay, which is February 1, and that's sort of like the December 1 of an ongoing governor has to submit the budget by December 1.
We're ongoing. We can't move it to like October 1st.
So it would just say not later than February 1, and that would mean that the incoming governor could do it earlier if he or she wanted, but so that's the only change we've made here.
Motion?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the task force approve Appendix 4.
Appendix 4 has been moved. Any discussion of Appendix 4? Seeing none, any objection to the motion before the committee? Seeing none, motion carries.
I think there's a couple we have to revisit. Paul has one that is in the larger document that I think we were going to check with Paul on that. And
it's Appendix 9 in the larger document. If you recall, we had a discussion around the tax expenditure report and what items were not really in current practice. And the discussion was around F and G in Appendix 9, and the F, at least in my view, I don't think there would be a problem deleting it, which was the original recommendation. Not because it isn't important information, but it's not done now, and it's something that I think you would need a broader a process to do that, because you're comparing expenditures with tax policy. And that's the tax expenditure report doesn't really do that. The G was the one you discussed last time, and the suggestion initially was to delete it, but the purpose of the tax expenditures, while we get some mixed level of quality in terms of evaluation of those and identification of the purposes. It's something that is used extensively in the tax credit review process. That is the first step, really, to try to look at what the purpose is, and then whatever evaluation the agencies have done becomes the starting point for reviewing the credits, particularly those that are scheduled for sunset. So it is part of the process now. Department of Revenue has some kind of guidelines they use in terms of what they won't try to evaluate, for example, if it's de minimis in the revenue impact, if it's connected to the federal tax code. There's a series of things that they put in place in practice where it's not realistic to evaluate them. But that step is carried out for a number of the tax expenditures, and it becomes important information in the process.
Okay. Let's revisit where we ended with this in the last meeting when we went over. Had we agreed to eliminate both F and G, or were we taking it under consideration?
We had proposed to eliminate both F and G, and Paul argued, or not, he didn't argue. He's not an argumentative guy.
I pointed out.
He pointed out that at least G should be retained and that F could go. Because it's really, F is sort of a subjective thing, and
we don't really have the underlying capability to do F. Do we have a motion on that, just to probably keep G and delete?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the task force amend Appendix 9 to remove sub F, but keep sub G and the rest of the statute as written.
And resequence them as appropriate. So, okay. Any discussion? Any objection to that motion? Seeing none, motion carries.
And then there's another one that we passed over before because Mr. Jordan was not available at the last meeting and wanted to discuss regarding the ability to move positions around. And
Appendix 33, Section 5 is the last sheet of your packet. Section 5 basically gives the governor and the Department of Administrative Services the ability to transfer vacant positions authority between agencies. And to my knowledge, and Ken and George have a longer history with this, but to my knowledge, that authority hasn't been used in the past. And I think some of the discussion originally among folks was, if it's never been used, why do we have it in the statute? And I guess I would just argue that we're in the process, and the legislature has passed a fairly significant amount of policy change regarding the way we deliver services to Oregonians through coordinated care organizations, through early learning hubs, regional solutions. And what we're finding is, and in fact the governor is asking agencies in his proposed budget to take a really hard look at repurposing positions to try and get human resource, if you will, deployed to actually execute on many of these policy changes, because they really are a different way of doing business for the state in collaborating with local communities and regions. We can do that during the budget proposal process, but in between budgets, it's difficult for us to repurpose positions kind of in real time. You all know we also get a quarterly vacancy report, which gives us vacancies that have been vacant for longer than 6 months. I would anticipate that we're going to take a much harder look at those vacancies going forward, and when they remain vacant for extended periods of time in agencies, especially where we're trying to change our business model, we may take a look at moving those positions from one agency to another, one program to another, et cetera. It does not change the overall expenditure authority of agencies. They wouldn't be able to take the money and move the money from agency to agency. It would be the position authority. Obviously, you probably wouldn't do that if you didn't have the ability to at least fund that position during the current biennium, coming in with the next budget and actually changing the permanent financing for those position changes. So it really, I know it's never been used, but just as the governor's kind of manager guy, I would tell you that we're having serious discussions about how to repurpose positions to try and accomplish the policy changes that have been made in the last 3.5 years anyway. So that's why I'd like to discuss it. And I'm sure there are other arguments about it.
Unlike Paul, I am an argumentative guy. So to me, it hasn't been used, and I understand Mr. Jordan's proposed use of it. I just think that I don't know how it got put in to begin with, but it seems to me that it's a delegation of legislative authority to the executive branch, and I would suggest removing it and allowing those kinds of transfers to happen during the budget process, and just have more of a conversation between the branches before this authority is just continued to be granted. And we have total confidence in Mr. Jordan's proper use of this, but being cynical in nature, sometime in the future, it could be, you know, misused, I think. So yeah. I would just be cautious about this.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Excuse me. After having a week and what appendix are we looking at?
Oh, excuse me.
33.
It's
33. The last page of the big packet.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Clarifying question.
Section 5?
Yep.
With the eBoard process, can eBoard do any of these functions you're talking about? If they came to eBoard and said, you know, we want to shift, eBoard doesn't have the authority to approve that.
No, but emergency board could. I mean, the premise behind here is that you establish, when the budget is adopted, you establish a position count, and that's it for the biennium. That's never happened because agencies come in, they get federal grant money or they get another program or something, and they're always asking for the establishment of positions. So if you don't have an issue with the initial budget authority or position authority being the final authority for the whole biennium, then the e-board can authorize the addition of new positions to do some of the things, but it just increases the position count because you still have a vacant position in one agency. Mm-hmm. Then you create a new position in the other agency to take care of this new program or whatever, instead of transferring that authority over. So,
well, I think this says, and it's been explained that way, I don't mean it's been not explained properly, it says transfer position authority among and within agencies, mm-hmm. which would appear to give the executive branch the authority to decide that a program that's, now not that there be one, but that there's a program in the Department of Agriculture that they now like to transfer over to another agency. Without any legislative decision making in that process in terms of whether that was appropriate or not.
It's difficult to imagine a hypothetical situation, Senator, where an entire program's staff would become vacant.
Yeah.
And then you'd transfer all those positions somewhere.
I know.
I suppose that's hypothetically possible. I'm not sure in reality.
But I think the language is broad enough to allow that to occur.
The language, I guess, if all positions for a program were vacant, I assume that that's possible, yes, under the current language. And
just speaking, go ahead.
No, I guess trying to get down to this, there really is a tension between the executive's ability to manage state government within the programs and the agency, the organizational construct that we have, and the legislature's ability to limit that authority through the legislative process by appropriation and in current and position count for agencies and programs, or parts of agencies in some cases. It's certainly, I'm with Ken, I have no idea when this was adopted and actually what might have triggered that statute to be put in place. And I guess I would also say that given annual sessions, it does give us between the branches more latitude to have flexibility on these questions. So certainly our situation today is different than when this was adopted, I think, the relationship between executive and legislative branch. And I guess I would also add, I can guarantee you, the first time we would use this authority, we would be in Ken's hip pocket talking about, we're going to try and do this once, and here's what we're thinking about doing, and how would that go? And, you know, because ultimately, if you do this, you're going to come back to the legislature for permanent financing authority of that change. So I guess that...
Because it does not change your constitutional authority.
No.
I mean, you should control the power of the purse.
You still limit.
Even if you transfer the program,
Very
unlikely to have enough empty limitation in the receiving agency to pull something like
to
that.
To do a full program. So.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you. I strongly agree with Mr. Rocco on this. And I think, Mr. Jordan, you mentioned that annual sessions, if we were still doing a two-year budget, it would make a lot more sense. But I do not believe that the legislature should be ceding any more authority to the executive branch than we already have.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Coach. Can't we have our cake and eat it, too, here? You know, I agree with Ken. I think, fairly strongly on it. However, I also appreciate in a rapidly changing society the needs that the executive department might have. But in relationship to this section, Ken, could we not include that this transfer of position authority is good until the next legislative session meets to confirm or reject, as the legislature might choose to do, that? I mean, that way the governor has the authority to proceed in this, which I assume is going to be kind of a crisis type of situation, although not necessarily. This gives the governor some flexibility, and it would give the legislature, it would protect the separation of powers, the role of the legislature in this. And we're talking about something at a maximum of 8 or 9 months, which probably is not going to break the bank.
Representative, and I'm not ledge counsel, but I think the authority or the ability of the legislature that you've articulated right there exists now, and that's the way we do business, regardless of what happens during the biennium. When we come back to propose the next budget, you have the authority to move those positions anywhere you want and move the money anywhere you want. And so I think that authority exists for the legislature today.
Without, Mr. Co-Chair, without being I'm meaning to be argumentative.
No,
on this.
I understand. But Ken do that. He's good at
it. The authority, I realize the legislature has the authority to go in and look at any of these situations at any legislative session that they have. However, it's something that the legislature must initiate the action, and therefore.
I see.
But if the position, immediately upon the adjourning of the next session disappears, it puts the responsibility on the requesting agency to say to the legislature, hey, we did this, we need you to either concur with us or provide us a new option.
Although I know historically there are issues about the e-board and what's the authority of the e-board, if you were to empower the e-board to make this kind of decision, or obviously the legislature would always be empowered, could you do that?
You'd need a constitutional amendment. The emergency board's a constitutional entity with defined powers in the Constitution.
Yeah,
specific.
Well, reject that.
That was my original claim. That's what I was fishing for.
You can do whatever you want.
Here's
the
problem. when we put this bill forward, we were looking for examples of problematic language
in current statute, problems of also things that were archaic or outdated. This is one of those clauses in statute that I can very easily see a member who doesn't understand the difference between a new member, that doesn't understand the difference between normal text and bold text, objecting to its inclusion because of the broad latitude it would give the executive branch to move positions. I don't know, I can only speak as the member of this task force and as the Senate co-chair, but I'm fairly uncomfortable with this clause.
Senator, I think it's relatively clear discomfort with the clause.
Mr. Chair, let's look at the Department of Corrections, for instance. Unfortunately, much of their a significant part of their operations is financed with vacant positions. That's how it's been done. I could see a governor in the future saying, "Wow, look at all those vacant positions. Let's just reach over there and take a few of those and put them over here and enhance my favorite program."
Probably. Mr. Co-Chair, so right now the status of Appendix 33, we have not voted on it. This is just this on the table and did not vote on it in the last.
I don't recall. I know we wanted to have this discussion,
and I don't know
if we took action.
On this particular one, we did not take action on, which is why it's deleted here and not mentioned
in
the appendix.
It's not in the matrix. No.
Because we did discuss it, and the conversation was essentially what we just had regarding
minus
Mr. Jordan,
argument.
And you'll notice that he was excused that day, and so the discussion.
I'm so glad I returned.
Well, we could have at least one motion here that wasn't by consensus.
We could.
So the question really is before you then, if you would want to remove or repeal subsection 5 of 291371. We did approve the other changes in Appendix 33 in that particular statute. We did not approve this one pending the return of Mr. Jordan, knowing that that was a discussion that was at that point one-sided. And so given the discussion now, the motion is now before you to repeal it or maintain it.
Mr. Kuchar, I would move that we strike subsection 5 in Appendix 33 as it is currently before us.
Any discussion?
thoroughly discuss the issue. I appreciate the time.
Okay. Do I need a roll call?
Probably do.
You probably just need to ask for objections.
Yeah. Okay. Any additional discussion? Any objections to the motion before?
For the record.
For the record, please note that Mr. Jordan and Mr. Naughton voted no. Remember this, once it's embodied and changes, it will be before a committee.
And
we'll be back under discussion again.
I want to thank all the committee members for having the discussion today. I really appreciate this.
It's a good discussion.
That actually basically concludes our work for today. Our next meeting is not until November.
Mr. Co-Chair, where we are at now is we have completed and the work of the review of the state budget process statutes. The final action of this committee will be to adopt and codify the statutes that we have suggested amending, repealing, or for that matter, retaining. We, and I say we, Mr. Naughton and Mr. Rocco and I have met with council, and they have begun to take the approved issues that we have already gone through and approved changes to, and they've begun a drafting process for us to look at these changes as a bill, and hopefully they will and have a little bit more clarity as to some of the changes. In addition to, we had several sections last time where we asked them to clarify and add some language, particularly around the composition of e-board, and add some language there, so we'll be able to see what that language looks like. So our next step before or on November 14th, which is our required reporting date, would be to approve our final report, which will include a full appendices and spreadsheet of all of the changes already before you, and then these new ones today, and hopefully be able to also review at least a preliminary LC draft of these changes to be presented as a bill for 2015 session. So depending on how council is doing with drafting and how long it takes them to proceed with some of these, we could potentially have a meeting sooner than November 14th. And otherwise, it would definitely be no later than November 14th. That is a Friday. And so we have a little bit of flexibility right now as council has begun that drafting process, and they'll be drafting many bills in the next couple months, and so we will see where they are at. That doesn't preclude us from finalizing on the spreadsheet and the appendices, knowing that those are going to be codified in a draft, but I would like to hopefully have a preliminary draft for everybody to review going forward. So that is where we're at now. So we will have one final meeting, whether it is on November 14th or before that, will kind of be timing as to how soon we can have a draft begin to see these changes come forward.
And all of that process, presuming that it can actually be filed in time, would enable the bill to be pre-session filed?
Correct, Mr. Co-Chair.
Okay.
That is the intent. That's why we have asked council to begin to take some of these changes already approved and begin that drafting process so as to have a measure to pre-session file for 2015 legislative session and to be before most likely a Ways and Means Committee in 2015.
And given that in my case and in the case of the members of the committee that are on the other side here are all within a short distance, we would try to provide ample opportunity to our three legislative members that are not in a short distance, actually, so that they can get plenty of notice of when the meeting would be.
Correct.
Yes.
We were talking, the last meeting, we talked a little about legislative performance audits. There is 171-580, actually 171-585, sub 2, gives the Legislative Audit Committee authority to accept requests for performance and program audits from individual legislators, legislative committees, divisions of audits, budget management, and the legislative fiscal officer. I'm not sure that anywhere in that statute it says that it authorizes the Legislative Audit Committee to perform a performance audit, but it can certainly recommend it. And then in 297.065, sub 2, the Joint Legislative Audit Committee shall provide oversight of the conduct of performance and program audits and program evaluations that are outside the authority of the Secretary of State. So once again, it gives the committee, Legislative Audit Committee, authority to recommend. But I don't believe, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Rocco, but I don't see anywhere in there where it actually gives the Legislative Audit Committee the authority to do performance audits.
Perhaps not. We could look at that specific language, but we've always operated under the belief that the Legislative Fiscal Office staffs the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and that committee can direct us to do a performance audit under its recommended, its powers of recommending that something be done. So we haven't recently done anything like that, but in the past we have, and recently the committee, it hasn't really met as a standalone committee. It's been combined with the Information Management and Technology Committee, which doesn't really exist in statute. They exist in statute as independent, separate independent.
It's probably an item that's going to be discussed in a 2015 session in terms of this. The practice has been there are two separate statutory committees. The practice has been for quite a long time to combine the two committees. And I think to some degree people have been unaware of actually the authorities that the audit committee actually has, because they haven't been exercised other than Well, one of the problems has been is one, well, we're on tape, but that's okay. It's a relatively small committee. It's a combined committee on two fairly complex areas, and it usually doesn't have much more time than to do what it's doing this afternoon and reviewing several state audits that have been done. Mm-hmm. And I think the Senate President, and I can't speak for the Speaker of the House, believe that that needs to change.
But to address Senator Whitsitt's point, I'm not sure if, and I guess this would be a question for council, I'm not sure if the Joint Legislative Audit Committee powers transfer to this combined committee. I don't know.
Well, yeah, that's another question actually out there, so. Okay.
Well, the other thing is there's a another task force that is studying the possibility of a legislative office of legislative policy. And one of the talking points in that discussion is should that office of legislative policy be authorized to do performance audits? It would seem that we already, if the statute is actually says that that the Legislative Audit Committee has that authority, it would be redundant at that point. It would be two different things.
Yeah.
Okay. Two different offices, neither of which are funded to do audits.
you're thinking that that's unusual.
I don't
for
think
things
it's
in statute
unusual,
to
but
be
I think
authorized
it, I think
and
that
not.
The legislature, I think I really think, Mr. Chair, that the legislature should be auditing. And I think that we could take back a lot more of our legislative prerogatives if we actually did that.
Yeah. Okay.
But we have to fund it.
Yeah.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yeah. Okay. Well, with that, I think we've concluded our work for today. And we'll keep people informed about the possibility of the next meeting. And I'll see some of you in a relatively short period of time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.